Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the alarming report from Oxfam released at the opening of the World Economic Forum in Davos that finds a 12% increase in the wealth of the world's richest billionaires in 2018, in contrast to an 11% drop in the wealth of the poorest half of the world's population, resulting in the world's 26 richest people owning as much as the poorest 50% of the planet's population. Paul O'Brien, the Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America, where he oversees research, policy, advocacy, and campaigning to influence the U.S. government and U.S. corporations, joins us to discuss this growing disparity in wealth, indicating we are heading towards a form of global feudalism. We will look into Oxfam's proposal for a global 1% wealth tax that would raise $418 billion a year, which would be enough to educate every child not in school and provide health care that would prevent 3 million deaths annually. And since between 2017 and 2018, a new billionaire was created every 2 days, and most of the world's richest individuals are American, the fact that $7.5 trillion in hidden wealth exists in tax havens indicates that it is time the wealthy paid their fair share of taxes. Then, as the impasse over the government shutdown continues, with the White House insisting on money for Trump's wall, while the House Democrats insist that Trump end the shutdown before negotiating border security, we will speak with Darrell West, the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. He joins us to discuss his forthcoming book, Divided Politics, Divided Nation: Hyper-Conflict in the Trump Era, and how much in common right-wing populists in America have with left-wing populists, and how they appear to be poles apart, yet little divides them. Then finally, we'll examine the reinterpretation on the right of the viral video of a Kentucky high school student in a Make America Great Again hat who was in Washington for a pro-life rally, smirking in the face of a Native American elder. Jared Holt, a research associate at Right Wing Watch, joins us to discuss his article, Viral Video Showing Catholic High School Student Prompts Propaganda Warfare, and President Trump's attempt to lionize the student as a victim of a smear by the fake news. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Paul O'Brien, the Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America, where he oversees research, policy, advocacy, and campaigning to influence the U.S. government and U.S. corporations. Previously, he worked in Afghanistan for 5 years in the Office of the President and the Ministry of Finance as an advisor on aid coordination, development planning, and policy reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul O'Brien.
Nice to be on.
Well, thank you, Paul, and your new report from Oxfam, of course, is presented to the World Economic Forum in Davos, and the headlines basically are that the 26 richest billionaires own as many assets as the 3.8 billion people who make up the poorest half of the planet's population. And there's been a 12% increase in the wealth of the very richest, in contrast to a drop of 11% in the wealth of the poorest half of the world's population. So this would indicate we're heading into some kind of form of global feudalism.
Right. Well, I think that is an interesting and accurate way to put it. And it's been a trend that we've been witnessing now for quite some time since we launched our inequality work in around 2011 and started to show up at Davos and ask these global leaders to pay greater attention to structural inequality, things have only gotten worse. The trend is going in the wrong direction.
And what is driving this trend?
Well, essentially, it's factors at both ends of the wealth spectrum. So on the richest end, where you now have a new billionaire joining their ranks every 2 days, right? So they gained about $2.5 billion a day last year in wealth, or nearly $1 trillion over the course of the year. What is driving that? It's a set of factors that is basically about under-regulating their wealth and income, whether it's personal income, whether it's personal wealth, or whether it's the monies that they hold through shares in corporations. Because corporations are being systematically under-taxed, as well as wealthy individuals, what we're seeing is an accumulation of wealth sitting in stocks. And most of the wealth of the world's richest lies there. That's why 1% of Americans now owns 35% of the wealth. It's sitting there, and it's particularly problematic with billionaires. On the other end of the scale, why are people falling further and further behind? We believe it is partly a function of an underinvestment in the services that are absolutely demonstrated to reduce inequality. Healthcare, education, social protection for the most vulnerable, and disproportionately investing in women and what they need to enter the workplace, the kinds of services that allow them to use their time more productively. Today, we are, and I mean literally today, 262 million children, by our estimate, will not be able to go to school because there's no funding for their education. 10,000 people will die today around the world because their healthcare systems are underfunded. And women will spend somewhere a little over 16 billion hours in unpaid care work because there's not enough investment in the kinds of services that frees up their time to be used more productively, whether it's water, electricity, basic childcare, infrastructure, or those social protections that guarantee their time is used in the most productive way in inclusive economies. So the problems are on both ends of the spectrum.
But is the offshore system of hiding money, where billionaires tend to have their money stashed, particularly Russian oligarchs, for example, there is a kind of wealth protection industry of accountants and lawyers around the world. And my understanding is that enormous amount of this wealth that you're talking about, Paul O'Brien, is simply hidden and it's not taxed.
Yep. We estimate that hidden wealth of the richest sits at around $7.5 trillion. That number is so large that it's hard to put it in context. If you add up the entire global economy, every bit of industry and effort by every single person across the globe in a given year, you're probably talking that number of hidden wealth is about 10% of all of that is hidden away, adding no value to anyone except the owners of that wealth. So it is a chronic problem. It's not just oligarchs and in less regulated environments either. What we are finding in our tax work and in our looking at the private sector is the corporations, often large U.S. corporations, are using the under-regulation in the global tax system to pay their taxes in the least expensive context, whether or not their economic activity happens there, to hide taxes as best they can and to hide their financial deals and flows so that it's as untransparent as possible so that it cannot be taxed. And where possible, they will engage in profit shifting and avoid taxes, which is entirely legal. This isn't tax evasion. This is avoid taxes by moving their monies into essentially tax havens so that they can declare their profits, not where their economic activity is happening, but where the tax rates are as low as possible. Through all of these mechanisms, which are bolstered, of course, by armies of lobbyists in Washington to make sure that the legislation allows them to do it, U.S. corporations and many other global corporations are starving domestic economies of the resources that are required for healthcare and education and social services. Big part of the problem.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul O'Brien, who's the Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America, where he oversees research, policy, advocacy, and campaigning to influence the U.S. government and U.S. corporations. And previously, he worked in Afghanistan for 5 years in the Office of the President and the Ministry of Finance as an advisor on aid coordination, development planning, and policy reform. So when Oxfam is presenting this new report to the World Economic Forum in Davos, they're also recommending a 1% wealth tax, a global wealth tax that would raise an estimated $418 billion a year, which would be enough to educate every child not in school and provide health care that would prevent 3 million deaths per year. It would seem to me that in conjunction with a 1% wealth tax, what we just talked about surely has to be addressed as well, because there's so much money that's being hidden from taxation.
Yes, you're right. It's a both and. We like the wealth tax idea. It's something that has been increasingly talked about over the last few years. Some innovative economists came up with it. I'm not sure if Piketty and Seitz in Berkeley were the originators of the idea. We had proposed it in many conversations in other contexts, but it's certainly something that is now got a lot of currency because, it's commonsensical. If you've got idle wealth at the levels of wealth which literally are so powerful now that they can change the fates of currencies or countries, wouldn't a small tax on that wealth, which could be used, as you say, for such good purposes, wouldn't it make sense? Well, one of the good things about that proposal is that to implement it, you have to do a lot of other things besides. You can't engage in global taxation of wealth from people who can move their money into whatever market they want to move it into, or jurisdiction, if you don't have transparency, if you're not able to follow where money flows and on what instruments are being used to hide it. And so if you tackle the foundations necessary to impose a global wealth tax, you're going to tackle many of the foundations you need to stop corporate tax avoidance and other ways in which those who have too much power are able to use that power to underpay on their taxes.
So how would you get a global tax regime started? I mean, it seems a daunting task.
Well, the first thing I think you have to do in this era is you have to build a public conversation which recognizes the state of the problem and is willing to seriously consider these kinds of ideas as a part of the solution. And from where we started maybe less than a decade ago, where people said, yes, inequality is a problem, and surely it's a natural part of functioning markets, people are now openly across the board, including political leaders, including institutions like the International Monetary Fund, which had been an antagonist to efforts to address structural inequality historically, they're all saying the same thing, which is at the levels of extreme inequality we're at now, it is actually undermining economies, it's undermining the health of polities, it's creating instability in our world. Even the people at Davos themselves are saying, who have been the beneficiaries of this, are saying we have to do more to tackle the root causes of what has given us all this wealth and power. So it's been a huge change in the conversation. That is a first step, because until political leaders believe it to be in their own self-interest to talk honestly and creatively about this with their own voting publics, you're not going to get movement. We're seeing that now. But then, as you rightly ask in your question, it's going to take more than that. We're going to need instruments. Oxfam has been calling for some kind of global body that has the ability to create both the regulatory environment but also the sanctions and the incentives to actually monitor global wealth so that it can be taxed and then to put in place the tax regime to do it. That would probably have to be led by a multilateral institution like the United Nations, and we've been calling for that in years past. And then, of course, in the end, you need the actual regulation or legislation that could be done at the global level and then applied in national environments. you need the G20 leaders to step up and say, let's lead a race to the top, not the bottom. Because in the end of the day, they accept that all our economies gain from markets that actually benefit innovation, hard work, and creativity, rather than who has the best lobbyists and lawyers to be able to hide wealth.
Well, of course, it would seem number one on the agenda would be to close these tax havens like the Cayman Islands and the Cook Islands, and all around the world they exist. And even Jersey and Guernsey have been longstanding ones, not to mention Switzerland itself. But again, going back to the main findings here, or at least the ones that have grabbed the attention around the world of this new Oxfam report, that the fortunes of the world's 26 richest individuals reached $1.4 trillion last year, the same amount as the total wealth of the 3.8 billion poorest people on the planet. The world's richest man is Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon. His fortune increased last year to $112 billion. And also, the United States seems to be where most of the richest people are, not just Bezos, but Microsoft's Bill Gates and Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. They're collectively worth $357 billion, according to Forbes. So if we've got the richest people on the planet, maybe we're the place to start.
Yeah. A 1% tax on Jeff Bezos' wealth could pay the entire health budget of Ethiopia. That's a country of 105 million people. Could live with a health system that was funded by just 1% of one individual's wealth. That level of power sitting in the hands of somebody who, you know, we hope and we see some signs willing to do some good with it, is distorting in our world. And as you say, a lot of that power sits in the hands of American billionaires. And there's absolutely no way we are going to get a global solution to extreme wealth being underregulated without American leadership and engagement. And that's why it's been so deeply problematic for us that this president, President Trump, has chosen to use his moment for tax reform to do precisely the opposite, which was to reward the extremely wealthy with a system designed to boost the stock market, from which the U.S. extreme wealthy particularly benefit, but not to actually address the fundamentals of the American economy and to help Americans lift themselves from poverty. So we now have an American economy that is not doing right by women in the workplace, and is not doing right by American workers, and is increasingly concentrating wealth, even in the United States, in the hands of fewer and fewer people. People say that it's the American dream to be able to work hard and get what you like from working hard. But when all of your hard work leaves you stuck in exactly the same place, if you're on the poor end of the spectrum, and you are able to exponentially increase your wealth just by watching stocks go up if you're on the richest end of the equation, that's not fostering the American dream. It's undermining it.
Well, it seems to me that what Oxfam's trying to do, which is to start a debate, and particularly choosing the forum, the World Economic Forum in Davos, as a place to start, seems like a perfect target. But interestingly enough, here in the United States, the debate has begun over taxation, and it was begun by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who appeared recently on 60 Minutes and suggested that the top earners in the U.S. who earn over $10 million per year should be paying at a top rate of up to 70%. And, of course, that was greeted by all kinds of alarm from the political class. But then it turns out that The Hill commissioned a poll, and they found that 59% of registered voters support raising the top marginal tax rate to 70%. And surprisingly, among Republican voters, 45% of GOP voters say they favor a 70% tax on the wealthiest, above $10 million. So, you know, there's popular support.
Yes, there is, and its time has come. This is probably a cyclical phenomenon. In 1945, the top tax rate in the United States was 94%, and then in that period we entered a period of broad-based inclusive growth, where the United States became the world's global economic power. By 1970, the top marginal tax rate around the world, including the United States, was 62%. So still incredibly high. Today, people are balking at a tax rate that the maximum marginal tax rate is 38%. So what we may be seeing is a return to a better level of balance where people understand you can still have the American dream if you've made so much money that you are now in the very highest tax brackets to pay a significant chunk, we would argue the majority of that wealth, back into a system so that others can also profit. It is a problem that in the United States today, 30 people have the same wealth, 30 people have the same wealth as the poorest 50% of the population. That's in a country of over 300 million people with an average GDP per capita of around $60,000. They still have as much as more than 150 million Americans. There are 585 billionaires here that have a total wealth of more than $3 trillion. And it's their wealth, the billionaire wealth in the United States, has more than doubled since the 2008 crisis. And this, of course, surprise, surprise, all these benefits are disproportionately going to men.
And just in closing, though, the United States is not the only country with this unfair division of wealth or the disparity of wealth, which is growing. The poorest 10% in the United Kingdom are paying 49% effective tax rate, whereas the richest 10% are only paying 34%. So that's just amazing that in the UK they could get away with such disparity.
Yeah, and around the world, increasingly, these underregulated tax regimes are leading to what are regressive taxes. The richer you are, the less you pay. But I'm glad you brought it back to that, because for Oxfam, perhaps one of our greatest concerns in launching this year's report is that for those people just living above extreme poverty, which is at $1.90 a day, but they only having $5.50 a day, they are the ones who have seen their relative wealth diminished by about 11%. So they are increasingly struggling to stay even where they were, while billionaires' wealth increased by 12%. And they are living in many of the 90 countries where Oxfam works, and we are trying to work alongside them as they look at their wealthiest citizens and say, why are we not building more inclusive economies in which we can all profit?
Well, just to close, Paul, a recent study found that 45% of Americans or American households are a $400 emergency payment away from penury. And when you have so many government workers now not getting paid, and on Friday they'll miss their second paycheck, you have to realize that if 45% of Americans are a $400 emergency payment away from literally being on the street, then the government workers that are not being paid have to be among that figure. And
sure.
And this is,
and
just
in Washington, where I live, many friends and people I know are they're now facing their second no paycheck and thinking, how do I feed my family and how do I keep going? And they're looking at the political class and they're saying, do you really understand what it's like to be on the wrong end of an inequality equation? And show us that you are committed to our welfare. And thank goodness we live in a vibrant democracy where people are going to engage on these questions. And if the powerful elites, both politically and economically, don't give them answers, they are going to find hopefully peaceful ways to show their dissatisfaction with the answers we've come up with. And Oxfam hopes to be a useful part of that conversation.
Well, Paul O'Brien, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul O'Brien, who's the Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America, where he oversees research, policy, advocacy, and campaigning to influence the U.S. government and U.S. corporations. And previously, he worked in Afghanistan for 5 years in the Office of the President and the Ministry of Finance as an advisor on aid coordination, development planning, and policy reform. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the stalemate over the government shutdown and our divided politics and divided nation and hyper-conflict in the Trump era.
Baby, you're the rich man. Baby, you're the rich man too.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Darrell West, the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and the author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust and Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval, and Social Strife in the 21st Century. His forthcoming book is Divided Politics, Divided Nations, Hyperconflict in the Trump Era. Welcome to Background Briefing, Darrell West.
Ian, nice to be with you.
Well, thanks, Darrell, and your book could not be more timely. Here we have a government shutdown with the House Democrats and the White House pretty much dug in. Do you see any chance of a break in the impasse?
Well, ultimately, there will be a break because you cannot keep the government shut down indefinitely. There's just too many people being hurt. We're already seeing a lot of stories in the news media about people not being able to make their loan payments, having to go to food pantries in order to get fed. So it certainly can't continue for that much longer. But it does illustrate this broader problem of just the extreme polarization we have, the disruption of government, the fact that government's not functioning very well. So we have to deal with that longer-term issue in order to make sure stuff like this doesn't keep happening.
But do you think that having the Senate basically carry Trump's bill and put it to a vote, that's designed, of course, to put pressure on the House Democrats, they're basically saying, no, we're not going to deal until you open up the government. And they don't want to accept a precedent where every time Trump doesn't get his way, he shuts down the government. Do you think that what seems to be a reasonable stance is going to carry the day, or is the fact that the government workers are not being paid and they won't get their second paycheck on Friday, that is, of course, growing pressure on both sides. So how do you think this is playing out tactically?
I mean, the big narrative still is average workers of modest means not getting paid. And we know many people have to live paycheck to paycheck. So not getting their second paycheck is really going to be devastating for people. And if you look at how this is playing in the court of public opinion, so far, Democrats have been winning the messaging war. I looked at five national surveys last week, and the average shows by a big margin many more Americans blame Trump for the shutdown than congressional Democrats.
Well, the proposal, of course, that Mitch McConnell is putting forth and that the president announced on Saturday essentially is he's going to give a temporary fix to problems he created since he was the one that shut down DACA and TPS.
I don't think that's going to fly with House Democrats. Speaker Pelosi already has rejected that. Trump floated a temporary fix to the DACA problem and extending some protections for those seeking asylum. But those are only temporary measures, whereas the wall would be permanent. So Democrats do not view that as a good deal from their standpoint.
And my understanding is that the polls indicate nationally that the wall is not popular. Is that so? Is that playing to the advantage of the Democrats here?
Well, the wall is not popular, but border security is. So over the weekend, we did see Speaker Pelosi put $1 billion more into border security. She wants to make sure Democrats don't get blamed for being weak on border security. But this fight is really not about mainstream public opinion at this point. It's really about playing to the base, because that clearly is what Trump is doing, and that is what has motivated his position on the shutdown.
And again, I'm speaking with Darrell West, the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust and Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval, and Social Strife in the 21st Century. And his forthcoming book is Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyperconflict in the Trump Era. So let's talk about, I mean, obviously, we're talking at a moment of hyperconflict and extreme division. And it has been growing, clearly. It's not just entirely a manifestation of the arrival of Donald Trump, but I think it's fair to say that Trump has exacerbated these divisions, if not exploited them.
Absolutely. I mean, the book, I talk about the longer term history and how we got to this point of extreme polarization. I have an unusual background in the sense that I grew up in a conservative rural community in Ohio, but then taught at Brown University for a number of years, which is a pretty liberal institution, and then now have ended up in Washington, D.C. So basically, I have lived among both the liberal and the conservative tribes. The book draws on 40 years of conversations with family members and friends. So I try and kind of talk about how we got to this point of extreme polarization, and then perhaps more importantly, what can we do about it?
So what are the factors driving it? Because it seems to me that the new technology, internet technology, and platforms like Facebook, et cetera, where I believe 2/3 of Americans get their news, they tend to share news amongst themselves, so their preconceived bubble, if you will, is shared. This, I think, has contributed to the polarization, and there are other factors as well. So walk us through what you think are the main factors in exacerbating this division in this country.
I mean, technology certainly bears some of the responsibility for this, because there seems to be growing evidence that the new digital technologies encourage extremism, because it's possible if you have a view that is really outside the mainstream, it may be hard to find like-minded people in your local community, but through the internet, you can basically find them easily through an internet search. But in the book, I also talk about what's driving public frustration, why people don't trust politicians, why they think the system is rigged against them. We've seen a big loss of public trust in the government. And I think the loss of economic opportunities that we've seen for the middle class over the last 40 years plays a major role. Income equality is a big problem. We know the wealthy are getting even wealthier, but people of average means haven't really gotten a meaningful wage increase in almost 40 years. They are understandably frustrated at that, but they're not sure who to blame. And so, you know, some people are blaming government. Big government is the problem. Democrats are more likely to blame Wall Street or large financial firms or some of the new technology companies. And so as long as people have a different diagnosis as what's going on, that accentuates and creates even greater polarization.
So in effect, Darrell, you're talking about kind of left-wing populism versus right-wing populism. Donald Trump got elected on what you could describe as right-wing populism, even though a lot of the coverage was of the people with the MAGA hats, you know, being kind of hillbillies. It turns out that most of the people that voted for him were reasonably wealthy. I think the average annual salary was something like $70,000, mostly relatively well-off conservative white Americans. And of course, on the Bernie Sanders side, you had left-wing populism emerging, challenging Hillary Clinton. So is there a way for the populism part of it to kind of merge? In other words, one of the things that was interesting about the 2016 race was that Donald Trump never really went after Bernie Sanders, because he knew that a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters also supported him, and vice versa.
Absolutely. Like, if all the populists got together and were a unified force, that would be a powerful political movement that would elect sympathetic politicians who would make radical changes in America. But as you suggest, there's a division between the right-wing populace versus the left-wing populace in terms of who they blame for the problem, as well as what are the solutions they propose. And that division basically keeps what could be a very powerful political movement from really forming and have impact. And then, of course, when people don't see impact, they don't see policy change, they become even more frustrated. So it kind of reinforces political extremism and political polarization.
Well, it does seem that Donald Trump pulled off an extraordinary sleight of hand. He ran as a right-wing populist, told everybody what the problems were, many of which he identified correctly, particularly campaign finance, said, you know, I'm a guy that's given money to all these politicians, including all of these Republicans on the stage with me I'm running against. That really resonated, and talked about draining the swamp, etc. But even a cursory look at what policies have been passed by him in the Republican House and Senate are all in favor of the plutocrats, the 1% or the 1% of the 1%. I think it's absolutely clear. So is there an awakening waiting to happen here with Trump's base?
There is a possible awakening in the sense that we saw some elements of this during the 2018 midterm elections, where Democrats made very large gains in the House of Representatives. And in large part, it was basically people saying there's a big problem. Trump betrayed his 2016 campaign rhetoric about the system being rigged and he would clean up the swamp and take steps to really make things better for ordinary people. He has not really delivered on any of those commitments. So that does create an opportunity in 2020 for other populists to come along and envision a policy agenda that is perhaps better suited to cleaning up politics, restoring public confidence in government, unrigging the system, and helping people of average means get more economic opportunity in their lives.
So do you think he was cynical, or do you think he basically was stymied? I mean, first of all, he had 3 million fewer votes than the person who lost, which is in itself a pretty strange situation. And then all of the promises sort of went by the wayside because he depended so much on the House and Senate, on Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. And they're clearly, if they're not in the pocket of the Koch brothers and plutocrats like that, they are certainly doing the bidding of the rich and powerful. So what happened there? Was there ever... I'm trying to give Trump the benefit of the doubt, even though I'm extremely suspicious of him, to say the least.
I mean, we know that he does not have a well-defined policy agenda, because when you look just over the last few years at what he has said, there's not a lot of consistency. He changes his mind a lot, and sometimes the last person he speaks to becomes his view. And so I think from the Congress side, both Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McConnell basically converted what would have been his populist movement and his populist agenda into a conservative movement and a conservative agenda featuring tax cuts, deregulation, and a tough stance on border security. And I think that has made people cynical about politicians in general when they see them saying one thing but then doing something else. But it does create an opportunity for someone else to come along, perhaps with a policy agenda that is more suited to reviving economic opportunity.
But meanwhile, the means by which Donald Trump was elected and what keeps his base together is very much the kind of Fox News bubble. And it's interesting to follow what they're doing. For example, Tucker Carlson just did a segment where he gave an almost Bernie Sanders critique of excessive capitalism, but then he wrapped it all up in a phony culture war rhetoric. And at the end of the day, you know, it seems in many ways that Fox is quite cynical about peeling off the populist discontent amongst working Americans, but essentially at the end of the day, getting them to vote for plutocratic agenda.
I mean, since I think the loss of economic opportunity is one of the key things driving the polarization today, I think politicians in the future have to be careful to really put forward an agenda that addresses that. When people kind of get sidetracked on culture wars or other kinds of issues, it's not really addressing the primary source of the problem. And so, therefore, it's not really going to produce the results that voters are looking for.
But in your book, Darrell West, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, it's pretty clear that they're the winners and they continue to be the winners. And we always talk about growing inequality. I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed who've written books about it, etc. But nothing changes. I mean, the latest Oxfam report has 26 families controlling half of the world's wealth.
Income inequality is a huge problem right now, and we're going to need policy solutions that really take that seriously. And that means changes in tax policy, the way that we support education, how healthcare is financed. I mean, much of public policy over the last 40 years has moved in one particular direction, it's going to take a while to reverse that, but there are people out there now talking about that issue. They're putting policy proposals on the table, and I would expect that issue is going to be a major issue in the upcoming 2020 elections.
But my question is, and my puzzlement is, Darrell, that we talk a lot about it, and I've been having people on my program talk about it for years now, but nothing changes. If anything, the polarization gets worse. That's my puzzlement. So what's driving? Is there something inexorable about inequality? Are we heading back to a kind of global feudalism?
It does not have to end in that version. And if that's what happens, that will be a very sad outcome for all of humanity. I mean, I think we still control our fate in the sense that even though people talk about inequality, we have actually not put serious proposals on the table that really address that. And so in order to move forward and reduce some of the polarization, we have to address some of those underlying factors like inequality and a lack of economic opportunity that really drive the public frustration, make them mistrustful about the whole situation, and lead them to think that the whole system is rigged against themselves.
So in other words, if a politician came along and said, look, all of us have so much more in common, and most of it's to do with economics, you know, whether you're black, white, Latino, Asian, whatever, forget about racial politics and culture wars. Just focus on what we all have in common. We're living in a country where over 40% of Americans are a $400 bill, unexpected bill, away from penury. And now you've got almost a million federal workers not going to be receiving their second paycheck on Friday. They're in the same boat. So this is not a happy picture when you look at the reality of, that most Americans are facing. So is that what it's going to take, somebody that brings us together around our common economic status as opposed to being distracted by culture wars and race politics?
Well, my hope is that there will be people in the 2020 election who do emphasize that issue, that focus on the common economic status of people and put serious proposals on the table in terms of how to bring that about. I actually think if somebody does that, there's a real constituency for that in the country, that could be a great platform on which to run for the election. So I think we will get a serious test of whether it's possible to make that appeal and build that kind of a coalition in the next year.
Well, Darrell West, I thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to your book, Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyperconflict in the Trump Era. When's it coming out?
It's coming out in March, so very soon.
We'll talk then, but thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and the author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust and Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval and Social Strife in the 21st Century. And his forthcoming book is Divided Politics, Divided Nation, Hyperconflict in the Trump Era. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the reinterpretation on the right of the viral video of a Kentucky high school student in a MAGA hat who was in Washington for a pro-life rally smirking in the face of a Native American elder.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jared Holt, a research associate at Right Wing Watch, a project of People for the American Way, who previously tracked and provided analysis on French media for Media Matters for America. He specializes in alt-right and so-called new right media, in addition to the larger culture and influence of right-wing social media. And his latest article at Right Wing Watch is Viral Video Showing Covington Catholic High School Students Prompts Propaganda Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Holt.
Thanks. Oh, thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks, Jared. And obviously the news, the reporting on what we saw of those young high school kids from Kentucky wearing Make America Great Again hats, right, one of whom was right in the face of a Native American who was beating a drum and apparently singing some kind of peace offering in a chant. The smirk on this kid's face, the fact that he was right in the face of the Native American elder, indicated to me that this was what it was. Now, since then, there's been some reporting suggesting that what Trump calls the fake news have gone overboard. A number of the so-called liberal press have been clutching their pearls and trying to sort of say, well, maybe there's another side to the story. Fox News have jumped all over it, of course. And the president has been tweeting out today, Nick Sandman, that's the kid that we saw smirking in the face of the Native American. Nick Sandman and the students of Covington have become symbols of fake news and how evil it can be. They have captivated the attention of the world, and I know they will use it for the good, maybe even to bring people together. It started off unpleasant, but can end up in a dream. That's the way the president saw it. And of course, he also tweeted out a link to Tucker Carlson. So the idea that these poor kids with their MAGA hats have been smeared by the fake news media, that's the new narrative. So I don't really buy it. I mean, I reported it as it came out from witnesses that were there, including the Native American themselves who are being heckled. Build a wall was the chant. So how, at the end of the day, as the dust settles, where do we stand?
So to my best knowledge, watching the videos over the weekend as they were being released and shared on social media, I kept returning to this same point where these videos, one of them is 2 hours long, and I thank whatever web developer enabled speeding up YouTube playback. By the time I would get through the end of these clips, the fact still stands, right? Which is that the students from this Kentucky high school were acting in a way that was incredibly disrespectful of indigenous culture and this activist, specifically Nathan Phillips. But as these new videos have come out, the right-wing sort of propaganda mill, for a lack of a better term, has seized on every new piece of information to advance a narrative that people on the left, or people who even some conservatives who originally saw this video going viral and condemn the actions of these young men, started to shift a little bit. And it started with people that exist really in what is most aptly described or compared to a sewer in right-wing media. These are YouTubers that are pulling just incredibly audacious stunts to get attention. And then it trickles up into prominent Twitter personalities that don't have a lot to lose or have questionable credibility, and then eventually hooks its way into a more legitimate conservative outlet. In this case, the one that really set this in motion was Reason Magazine. And from there, it goes to Fox News. And if it's on Fox News, we all know that means eventually it will find its way to the president. So, what you described is, this has been a very concerted propaganda campaign from the inception. The minute this video came out, there was intense pressure to try to absolve the situation, which at the time was distracting massively from the March for Life rally, between Ben Shapiro's sort of humorous, you know, incredibly awkward comments about how no pro-lifer would kill baby Hitler and this viral video. The stories about the rally weren't about the rally themselves, so there was a lot of incentive.
Sure,
to
but just to interrupt you there, Jared, weren't these Kentucky high school, Catholic high school kids with the MAGA hats, they were there for the pro-life rally, weren't they?
Yes, they had been shuttled in, as many young people are, by their school to participate in this rally.
So what is the role then of these, I think there was three of these members, I think they're called the Black Israelites or something, or the Black mm-hmm. Hebrew Israelites. What's their story?
Anybody who lives in the Northeast Corridor has, you know, Dave Weigel at the Washington Post put it well. We've all just thrown in our headphones and tried to walk past them. They're a very bizarre sort of religious sect that is a very hardcore Black nationalist. And the group and its members often try to gin up attention by throwing out inflammatory comments, whether it be slurs against LGBT people, inflammatory statements about people being doomed to hell. You know, these are not really pleasant people to encounter in the street more often than not.
And do they hang out at the Lincoln Memorial or prominent places in Washington, D.C.?
I haven't seen them there. There's a metro stop in the middle of downtown that they're at, I think, once a month.
So the revised story from the right-wing press says that the reason these kids were chanting from the Catholic high school in Kentucky was to drown out the insults from the Black Hebrew Israelites. Is that what happened? I can't understand why a chant of Build the Wall would be. They say they sang their school song or something. What's the connection here in terms of excusing this behavior or trying to recast this behavior as not being disrespectful to the Native Americans, but rather a way to drown out the Black Hebrew Israelites?
Yeah, so in the footage that I reviewed before reporting out my story, it appears, you know, and we're just working off available footage, that the first sort of back and forth between two groups that these students were engaged with were between the Black Hebrew Israelites and the students. And at that point, they were doing sort of school spirit cheers, that sort of thing, to drown out the other group. But then when the indigenous activists came into the scene, you know, with the drum and the songs, that attention was directed to them. So the point still stands that this energy that had been they had, you know, whipped up was expressed in a wildly inappropriate and ugly way to Native American activists. So I don't think it really, from a factual standpoint, I think it sort of serves as like a red herring. So by pointing to the prior back and forth with the Black Hebrew Israelites, conservative media is sort of hoping to absolve the second part, which is the most important part of the story, which is the teenager's behavior to the Native American activists. And, you know, that was what people were upset about to begin with.
Well, I must say it's a bit rich that Donald Trump is suddenly becoming the, you know, kumbaya president, talking about bringing us all together. But this whole thing can end in a dream. I don't know why I use the word dream, particularly with the issue over the Dreamers, which the Supreme Court just threw Trump a wrench today. But mm-hmm. the fact that he's been calling Senator Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. And then early in the month, he tweeted out that Elizabeth Warren, when she released her video, it would have been a smash if she did it from Bighorn or Wounded Knee with her husband dressed in full Indian garb. Now, this prompted the Republican senator from South Dakota, Mike Rounds, to invite Trump to visit tribal communities in South Dakota. And Senator Rounds tweeted out, "The Wounded Knee Massacre was one of the darkest moments in our history. It should never be used as a punchline." So, I mean, even Republicans are calling out Trump on his dog whistles about Native Americans. So the idea that he's the champion of this new version of what happened on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, I find it a little hard to take.
Yeah, and I think that is part of the reason why, you know, the internet on Friday and Saturday, people were reacting so, aggressively to this video, you know, calling it disgusting and racist and whatnot, because I think what people see in the video is, as you said, the embodiment of something that Trump and the era of politics he has brought in has really acted to exacerbate. It's this, you know, riling of, you know, the Republican base's anger and directing that anger through ridicule and sometimes just pure vitriol towards groups of people that don't look like them.
So just to wrap it up then, Jared Holt, where do we stand? I don't know. My sense is that what I saw is what I saw, and it was pretty unequivocal. And, you know, you always, if you've made a mistake in reporting, you always want to retract it. But mm-hmm. I don't feel the need to retract anything. I just wonder whether these explanations really make any difference to what I saw, the smirk on that kid's face right in the face of the Native American elder. I don't know why else you'd do that. It certainly wasn't an act of love.
No, and I tend to let the age-old philosophy, when people show you who they are the first time, believe them, be a guiding light for me.
Right, and if you're wearing a Make America Great Again red baseball cap, you know, I think you're advertising a certain political attitude.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Well, Jared, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jared Holt, who's a research associate at Right Wing Watch, a project of People for the American Way, who previously tracked and provided analysis on fringe media for Media Matters for America. He specializes in alt-right and so-called new right media, in addition to the larger culture and influence of right-wing social media. And his latest article at Right Wing Watch is Viral Video Showing Covington Catholic High School Students Prompts Propaganda Warfare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with the man she loved. Time.
Yeah.